This is 20VC with me, Harry Stebbingston. If there's one element where the podcast is criticised for often, it's that I agree with the guest too much and that I do not push back enough on some ideas shared. Today, we completely tear that apart. The guest on the show is brilliant, but we have some very different opinions around portfolio construction. And so this is an awesome and very rare debate on 20VC. And so with that, I want to welcome an old friend of 20VC's to the show, David Tisch, founder and managing partner at Box Group, one of the leading seed-focused firms of the last decade, with a portfolio including the likes of Airtable, Glossier, PillPack, Plaid, and many more incredible companies. Prior to smashing the world of seed with Box, David was managing director of Techstars New York and was a prolific angel investor alongside it, making early angel investments in the likes of Vine and Warby Parker, to name a few. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. That is enough from me though, so now I'm very, very excited to head into what is an incredible discussion with David Tisch, founder of Box Group.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
David, it is such a joy to do this. I've wanted to do this one for a very long time, since our last episode, really. But thank you so much for joining me again today.
Thanks for having me back. I've spent the past year trying to come up with new material to talk about with you, so we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm sure we've got a lot to discuss. But for those that missed our first episode, like, tell me, how did you make your way into this very weird and wonderful world of venture? And what was that kind of founding moment for you with Box?
I think you have to date yourself when you go back and tell a story. And the world in 2010 or 9, when I started making early stage technology investments, it's just so different. Venture capital isn't this word that gets talked about in school. People aren't aspiring to join our industry. Startups are still in the rebel phase of what people are doing to go against what normal is. And I think today, when you look at it, startups are taught in university, they're taught in grad school. There's hundreds of different programs that allow you to start companies. It's just a different era if you go back as little as 12 years ago. And so for me, it was just a love of technology, the internet specifically, more than it was technology. And watching at that time, pre-mobile, that the internet, sort of that moment that they call Web 2.0 starting, where it started to unlock a combination of two things. One is like better software for doing things online. Connecting people was probably the biggest change, sort of the Facebook era. And the second was doing more things offline. So how do you use the internet to connect the world? And I think my head had always been oriented around falling in love with watching that happen from childhood days, that when I sort of figured out you could do this as a career, it was like, wow, this is what I should be doing. And so I started making a couple investments. I ended up joining Techstars to help launch and run the New York program. And at that point, I had accidentally signed up to be an investor. And so Box Group became my way to invest into companies that were outside of the Techstars ecosystem. And 9 years ago, left Techstars to do Box Group full-time. And so we've been doing it full-time for 9 years, and Box Group's been around for about 12 years.
I want to dive straight into a topic that I'm so passionate about, and I think we actually have quite different views on, so this will be quite fun. And it's portfolio construction. So how do you think about and how do you construct your portfolio today with Box?
I think it's really important in what we do to not worry about projecting our own internal problems
externally on founders. And so I'll get to your question directly, but I think indirectly, it starts there of I have a bunch of things I care about on my business side of the sort of coin. I don't think anybody needs to worry about those except me. And so when I meet a company, if I walk into that conversation saying, I need this much ownership or this is what works for my model, suddenly I've taken my own shit and pushed it onto the company. So I don't want to do that. Instead, what I want to do is say, are you an amazing entrepreneur? Are you a founder that we would be excited to back for years to come? And if so, can I invest in your company? And at that point, we can figure out a deal that works for them, that works for us, without letting them know all the things that I need to worry about that they shouldn't care about.
I totally get you and I understand. I think that's a really nice way to look at it. But I also go, you've got over 100 million in the new funds. You do have to put those elements front and center. And you also want to be respectful of people's time. And so if it's something that they can't accommodate, you don't want to waste their time on it. So I guess, like, how do you think about that perspective with scaling fund sizes, which means ownership?
Well, right back at you, right? I have $100+ million that I manage. I know what returns I have to make in order to succeed without much money. The founder doesn't need to care about that. I need to make sure that the founder is aligned to build a great company. And if they build a great company, I can figure out the math. I promise you, if we invest in unique outlier companies, our math works. Every VC's math works if you fund great companies. And so it's not about this like ownership threshold. If anybody owned 1% of Facebook, 1% of Uber, like 0.1% of Coinbase, your math works. Your math works really well. And it scales.
I mean, it does and it doesn't actually. If you're going to be blunt.
Why not?
If you're going to be blunt with it, because if you own 0.1%, you're looking at 100 million back. And yeah, that is great. And I'm not belittling that. But if that is...
But if you're telling me I managed $100 million and I got 0.1% of Coinbase, which costs me, if I did it at the seed stage, 50,000. So if I snuck into Coinbase with a 50K check and I got 0.1% of the company fully diluted at the end, and it's a $100 billion outcome, and I get $100 million back, I've now paid for my fund on 50K. I now need to return 3X the fund, 5X the fund. And guess what? I have another $99.95 million to do that with. So now I need to make sure that I do a couple more of those unique outlier companies, and I still have a huge chunk of the fund to invest. So you're allocating capital in a concentrated way, saying, I'm going to make a small set of bets. They're going to have a lot of ownership, and I need some of those concentrated bets to work. I'm saying my job is to fund great companies. And if I fund great companies, my math will work because it will work.
But then your model is predicated on having $100 billion companies. Like, I find that difficult to sleep because we both know how rare they are.
I said 0.1%, right? And now if you get to 1% or 2% or 3%, you're not dependent upon a specific size of an outcome. You can still do the math in a way that gets you to a fund return. I'm confident that our math works. I'm okay with people from the outside not believing that our fund math works. That's cool.
So how many companies do you think you have in a portfolio? Say, circa.
We've been doing this a long time. And so I think today we have probably over 300 active companies in the portfolio.
Okay. And so in each fund, you want to have, say, 50 or 60 companies?
More. Yeah, there'll be 80 to 100 companies in a fund.
Okay. So totally understand that. How do you find in terms of just like time and value add and where you spend your time with such a broad portfolio?
My job is to satisfy a customer is the company. And so if we're not doing that, we won't be in business very long. We won't get access to the next investment because founders are going to ask founders who work with us if we do that well. And so my job is to do that well. Is there some magic? I don't know. Do you have a product?
The product is like us.
Right. I call that a services business. I'm in the services business. My job is to service the entrepreneur. I need to make a customer happy. How do you make a customer happy? If you think about that analogy in any other context, every customer is different. And you need to walk into each relationship, understand who the customer is, understand what they're looking for, and deliver them a great service. We do that. We do that at scale. And we've done that for a long time.
One thing that I'm really interested in your thoughts here is like, we mentioned about not being so focused on ownership and not bringing kind of your shit to that conversation. I often hear managers say, I'm going to build ownership in my best companies over time. So I'll put in a 50K check, but it's just my foot in the door and then I can really double down. I don't really buy that model because I think with your best companies, with the capital proliferation that we have today, you name the tier ones, they come in and they eat the ownership. Like, understandably, I'm not dissing them. them, but they eat the ownership and you can't build ownership.
They're really good and they're doing what they should be doing, which is focusing on what they want out of this. Do I buy that every time? No. Do I think the only way to buy up in a company is to start by investing in the company? Yes. And the only way to buy up in a company is if you are worthwhile of the founder prioritizing you going forward. So do I think that like the blanket answer is write a 50K check, get on the cap table and buy up? No. Because if you're not magical to that founder, they're never going to figure out how to create an opportunity for you to do that. And so what I think happens is if you are, again, satisfying the founder in a way that they believe that you are worth prioritizing, you can over time increase your amount that you're investing in a company. It's not going to happen in every company, but it definitely can happen in certain companies. I think when we look at our portfolio, some of our unique breakout companies happen to also be the founders that we've built an incredible set of relationships with. And so if we look at Roe, the men's health company that just raised a big growth round, we backed Zach Z in the pre-seed. We did that alone. We wrote a check in a round by ourselves. We've been backing that company from the pre-seed all the way up through this round. We have a relationship where Zach is going to create an opportunity for us to lean in over time. And if we look at historically some of the best companies that we've been fortunate enough to work with, it nicely correlates with some of the best relationships that we have with our portfolio.
I totally agree with you in terms of the relationship driving, also the ability, as you said, to buy up in subsequent rounds. And when you have relationships like you do with Z, you absolutely can. So I completely agree with you there. Can I ask, I'm really nervous, honestly, today, David, when I see just generally pricing levels at our stage. Are you as nervous as me first?
I mean, maybe, but I feel like the past 10 years in this bull market, every year the prices have been, quote, too high, and every year they'll keep going higher and the outcomes keep scaling with them. We mentioned $100 billion. If I said $100 billion 3-5 years ago, it would be a joke. Yet today there are a handful, not a lot, but a handful of companies that enter into a liquid public market at above $100 billion. That's not a private market overhyped valuation. That's now a public market with liquidity that you can actually trade in and out of a company. And so we've now escalated the outcome size that you're potentially looking at. It doesn't mean that that happens for every seed company for $30 million valuation, but it does say that the market, the TAM overall that a lot of these companies are operating in and the business models are being responded to throughout the entire investment stack in a uniquely more positive way than they were previously.
So how do you think about your own price sensitivity then? You must have turned down deals because of price at some points. How do you think about when to pay up versus when not?
I think it is important to be price aware on a portfolio basis. And I don't think on a deal by deal basis, price is a determinant of making a decision. Pretty simple. If you love a company and you want to invest and the deal is what the deal is, you make a decision to invest or not invest. I don't control price. The market controls price. Now, on a portfolio basis, right? If I look at a fund and I say our entry point is up 3x from our last fund, that's a problem. So I need to have some understanding of the portfolio price, but I don't need to have rigid discipline on a deal price.
Got you. Okay, that makes sense, especially when you think about it from the portfolio perspective. One thing that I'm sure we've both seen, and it's happened actually in companies we're both invested in, is the rise of preemptive rounds. How do you think about preemptive rounds today? And when advising founders who suddenly have a Series A of 20 million on the table 3 months after the seed and very little to prove for it, and they're going, should I take it? How do you advise founders on preemptive rounds?
The word preemptive at some point is just sort of going to go away, right? If every round is a preemptive round, what does the word preemptive actually mean in that context, which is, I think, what we're seeing happen in this market. And so the speed at which a company is going from C to A or A to B is escalated rapidly. Not every company, but it's a lot of companies, and you're seeing it proliferate in a much more significant way throughout the entire market. I think if I'm a company and I start a business, my aspirations are to make a great business. You are not going to build a great business off of a seed round. There are very few companies that can get to real scale off of a seed round. It happens, right? There's exceptions to every rule. Zapier did it, and it's a magical company. Like, we can name a handful of them. So when you take the venture decision and you embark on that journey, you inevitably are going to raise another round if things go well. So I look at it like this. If I'm a company and a VC who's an adult and can make their own decisions offers me a round, I look at how much money would I want to raise when I want to raise that round? At what valuation would I want to raise that money? And what person would I want to work with? So if I'm getting as much money as I want at a price that I want from a person that I want, it's a no-brainer. You take the money.
And you don't worry about a company's ability to scale into said valuation.
That's their job. If they don't do that, they're going to fail. They're going to fail if they took that round or if they didn't take that round. If they don't execute, they need to be disciplined about how they spend that money to fill that valuation out. It's risky, but so is starting a company, and so is taking on venture capital, and so is giving companies early scaled capital. It's all risky. So what are you trying to de-risk here? Which part? The last part only? I don't think that that's like de-risking anything. The risk is still inherent of like, if they build a successful company, every round will look cheap. If they don't build a successful company, it will look like a bad investment. It's pretty binary. There's like the fallback side of VC, right? Which is like, they didn't get all the way there, but they got somewhere and it was an okay exit. I don't think that's the dynamic of this industry that anyone is focused on. There are certain investors that might at the late stage look at a different outcome size and a different outcome scale and invest around underwriting that risk. But I think when you look at the early stages, which today are seed A and probably in to B, there is enormous amount of risk, but there's enormous amount of upside that is coupled with that risk.
So you said that, you know, if they execute, it'll be a great company. And if they don't, it won't be a great company anyway. And that's like the argument against signaling often. How do you feel about it when people say about signaling risk, especially with multi-stage funds doing seed investing?
They've been doing seed investing for 12 years. Signaling risk is probably the most overrated soundbite. It's great. I use it, right? Every VC is going to use it when you're trying to figure out how to win your deal. But multi-seed investors are great seed investors. They've been great seed investors for a long time. Sequoia, Andreessen, Accel's been making early stage investments throughout their entire history. Union Square, like if you go back in time and look at some of their earliest investments, they're magical. I think if you look at all the multi-stage firms, their early investments have been very successful at points. It doesn't mean that their success rate's going to be higher, right? It means that they're going to still be making mistakes in terms of some companies they invest in. But in general, I think they're great investors. We work with everybody. We like working with everybody. We also like working with focused seed investors. I think they're equally interesting to work with. But I think that the myth of sort of you take a seed check from a multi-stage firm, especially in this market, that you're going to struggle to raise your next round if that firm doesn't sort of write the term sheet, I think that's been proven to not be a material determinant of like success.
I find the most effective argument that really resonates with founders is actually the price incentive misalignment when you have multi-stage funds in at seed. Because if we're seed stage focused firms like me and you both are, we're both aligned in terms of getting the best price for the next round. If you have a multi-stage firm in at the seed and suddenly they also want to lead the A, they're not aligned to you in terms of wanting to jack up the price.
That's real. That's 100% real. But that's where you need to get external optionality and leverage in order to negotiate that. But that's a fully real thing. I think to me, what I look at is if I'm a founder, I want to be the top half of someone's portfolio from a capital allocation standpoint. I want to be what their average check or above is. So taking a smaller check is an option for that fund. Inherently, it's an option. So you just have to be aware that that's what you are if you're taking that smaller check. Instead, if I look at a fund and say, what's your average check size? Okay, your average check size is a $15 million check. So if I'm going to take a $3 million check from you, you know that you're in the bottom quartile of money allocated from that fund. So assuming that you're going to get this magical attention allocation from the fund is a mistake. If you are great, you will eventually get that magical attention allocation. But early on, it's the wrong sort of assumption. If you're in the top half of their financial allocation, you are going to be paid attention to.
Could I apply that to you and us and say that if you got a 50 to 100K check, you're going to get less attention than a 500 or a 750K check?
Probably on some average out of the attention retention graph, yes. But I think if our intention is to write that first check in order to show that we're worthy of a bigger check, you might actually reverse that allocation. I think the multi-stage firms are more firm in their business. We're still playing with adorable money. I think that that's the challenge, right? Is that we're writing 50, 500K checks. And when you look at a sort of multi-billion dollar firm, they think we're cute. I think we're very confident that what we're doing is interesting and very valuable. And I take every dollar that we invest seriously, but I'm also okay being sort of underestimated in this market.
Do you want to scale up massively? Obviously, you've scaled.
No, we're great. What we do is what we want to do. We've been doing it for 12 years. We don't want to do anything different. We love what we do.
So we're not going to see a 500 million box group fund.
We believe our craft is early stage investing. We want to be excellent at investing in seed, pre-seed. We'll dabble into Series A's. We don't want to lead seed rounds. We don't want to lead Series A rounds. We want to be sort of second or third biggest check on a cap table. We want to do so in a collaborative nature. We want to do so in companies that we think are going to be great. And that's the business that we've built. We have a opportunity vehicle, which allows us to lean into some of our best investments. So I think when we think about scaling, that's our business, and we want to capitalize it in the best way to succeed at that business.
Do you find with the rise of micromanagers, that like second place position is being threatened, where people have lead investors, and then they have five micromanagers, your Jeff Morris Juniors, your Todd and Rahul's of the world, and that second place check doesn't actually exist as often as it used to?
I think every deal is different, and you have to go into every company and figure out if you want to invest, figure out what the round dynamic looks like, and figure out how to explain what you're selling and hopefully have the founders buy it.
Can I ask another thing? And I sound like really negative here. I'm like the old man of venture.
This is your aggressive interview tactic. I like it.
I'm just the other thing that really concerns me is when we see like managers go through.
I'm happy that you're concerned for me. I sleep okay at night. I panic about not investing in the next great company. I panic about missing something, but I don't panic about our business model. I think we're fine.
Another thing though that worries me, cadence of investing. People are going through funds in 12 months, 15 months. I remember this was not long ago when it was 3 years. How do you think about deployment pace for you personally?
I'd like to be on a 2 to 3 year fund cycle. 2.5 feels totally comfortable. 3 feels fine. 2 feels aggressive. I think anything ahead of that is not the business that I'm trying to build here. I want alignment. I said it to you, right? We're old. We've been around for 12 years doing this exact thing. We haven't changed what we do in 12 years. My intention is to do this for a lot more funds, many, many more years. And what that takes is a long-term perspective and not overreacting to a moment in time. We need to be in the market. We need to be live in the market, and we need to be doing a great job finding great companies and working with founders such that they want to work with us again and again, and that they tell all their friends that they should work with us. If we're doing that, we are going to build a great business. If we're not doing that, we will not have a new fund in 2 years or 3 years or 1 year.
You said you worry about kind of the missed opportunities element and ones that have slipped by. I totally share that. If there's like one that you think about.
There's all of them. Every company that is good that we had a chance to invest in, they all haunt me. They don't haunt my partners. It's actually great because they're like very zen and they're very confident and we're going to do our best and sometimes we're going to miss. They haunt me all day.
So when I say missed opportunity, what's the first one that comes to mind?
I don't know. We've missed so many companies. Like inherent in the seed business, if you're seeing a lot of things, is the idea that you're going to miss things and you're going to not get into things. You know, there's a company that we looked at called Stitch, which just raised a nice round. There's a company we looked at called Check, which just raised a nice round. And I think, you know, those are two that are more recently on the top of my mind where I'm like, you know, we were excited about those. I wish we had an opportunity to invest in them. I think our goal is to get into the companies that we want to invest into. And when that doesn't happen, I feel like we have to do a better job.
Have you ever changed what you do or the way you do it because of a miss or because of learnings from a miss?
Yes, all the time. I see the problem set in our business. First is see a deal. Second is make the right decision. Do you want to invest or don't you want to invest? And the third is get in if you want to invest. The fourth is add value after the fact. Add value attaches to number 1 and 3. If we're not adding value, we're not going to see the next set of deals, and we're definitely not going to get in when we want to get in because founders are going to reference check us and figure out if they want to let us in or not. So the add value part is not part of the first three core problems. I obsess over seeing a deal. What I think is the hardest part to get right and articulate and talk about is number two, is make the decision. That's the part that when we make the wrong decision, we spend a lot of time internally trying to figure out, what did we miss? What could we have done better? Where did we lean into that we should not have over-indexed in terms of our decision-making process? And what was the process that led us to the wrong answer on that deal? And that goes the same for making a yes decision that doesn't work. Sometimes the answer is good decision, good try, ran a great experiment, didn't work. But sometimes it's we made a bad decision to invest. But I'm more obsessed with the ones that we saw and didn't say yes to that feel like we can get better at that.
Was there anything specific that you changed? So I made a mistake once when I over-indexed on referencing specifically tied to their role in a prior company where they were an employee. And it turned out they just were shit employees, but fantastic leaders, and they had opinions and they were bold. But that wasn't a great reference. And so I over-indexed on a specific type of reference that led me to a bad decision. Is there anything like that which was specific?
I think that's a great example, right? There are people who will be great founders and are terrible employees. And so I think we learned that lesson very early on. Like, just because you were a bad employee, I was a terrible employee. I would never hire myself as an employee, but it doesn't mean that I can't run my own business. It means that I was a bad employee and they're very decoupled. Yeah, I think valuation's one that you talked about before, right? Don't pass on a deal because it's overpriced. If it's going to be a great company, that's the cheapest it will ever be. So you should probably invest. So that's one, is don't pass on valuation. I think don't pass on something because it's early. That's something that we orient ourselves around all the time. Our job is to squint and see where it's going. And so the more you're focused on the present, the more you're going to miss the potential for the future. And it doesn't mean the future is going to happen for every company, but our job is to be imaginative and dream with the founder and join their journey to go fulfill that dream. And so the more that you're focused on the present, the less you're going to be able to squint and lean into the dream. And I think that that's something that we really try to orient ourselves around in the decision-making process of like, well, if everything that they're pitching comes true, is this incredibly exciting? And then you come back to like, okay, do we think it's all going to come true? Do we think a lot of it's going to come true? And I think from a like mentality standpoint, that's how we try to approach decision-making more so than we do with fact-based decisions. Because if you're finding facts at the seed stage, you're going to be looking for facts all day.
The other thing that I've fucked up on before is when I've turned companies down consistently because of questions around market size. That has consistently led me to mistakes. I'm interested to hear if that's the same for you and how you think about market size as part of the decision making.
Yeah, and you know what? If you pass on something because of market size and the company doesn't work, you were right. It was market size. It wasn't a big enough market. If you pass on something and it works and you pass because of market size, they have expanded and created the market that you thought was too small. So it goes back to dreaming. It's a huge issue, right? If you sort of assume that the present market is the status quo going forward, that's incorrect. If you assume that all the things that they're pitching are correct and they succeed at all those things, they're going to expand the market and the market is likely big enough. If you are great at a market, most markets are pretty big. They're not necessarily, again, supportive of a $100 billion outcome, but if you're dominant in a market, no matter what it is, you can probably sustain a pretty scaled, exciting business. I think competitive landscape is different though, right? If there's a big enough market, but actually strong in too many competitors, figuring out the wedge into the market is a different lens of the market question that I do think is equally relevant to market size. And you can't just say, okay, big market, we're going to be the 18th player in it. I think when you do see those companies, DoorDash as an example, we're going to be the 12th player in this market. The market is big enough for multiple players, but it didn't mean that just entering the market enables you to be a big outcome. They had to figure out their wedge. They had to figure out how to beat all the incumbents that were ahead of them at the time and actually emerge as number one in what is a crowded and competitive market.
One thing that's like becoming more and more prominent for seed managers, but also for founders, and so it's kind of a twofold question, is the element of secondaries. Obviously, with the proliferation of capital, again, secondaries for founders is more available than ever. How do you advise founders to think about secondaries when they're on the table?
At different stages, I think there are different sort of thought process around it. Once the company is off the ground, the less a founder has to worry worry about their day-to-day life, the better. And if taking some money off the table enables their life to be easier to balance with their work, so they're not stressed about their living situation, or they're not stressed about a life choice that they need to make to sort of sustain equilibrium outside of work, I view that as a positive thing. And sometimes that just means increase your salary and pay yourself enough that you're not sort of waking up thinking about your short-term income. I think as companies get to scale, it really is about a risk-adjusted decision, right? Like, I think you've seen historically that the founders who want to scale exponentially keep putting their chips on the table. It doesn't mean that you can't take a couple off and create some balance in your life. So I think it really is a very personal decision and not something that is a generic piece of advice.
On the flip side of the table, you know, seed funds have the ability also to sell in terms of secondary transactions to much larger players in the later rounds.
We don't sell.
You don't sell?
We don't sell.
What about when a company goes public? How do you think about that, when to sell versus when to hold?
Carefully.
You're adopting the quickfire round before the quickfire. But do you take, like, you know, 30% off the table and ride the upside? Do you go, no?
It's so specific, right? If you had sold Shopify when they went public, you left like 100x on the table. So don't sell Shopify if you own Shopify as a VC when they go public. That you missed the actual bigger set of upside in that company. So it really comes down to each company and sort of understanding, again, this like risk-adjusted decision.
Final one before the quick fire, and it's the element of mental plasticity. You know, you've had many successes. Also, naturally, there's companies that haven't worked. How do you bring a fresh mindset to every opportunity when your mind is inherently tainted by successes and failures? So how do you prevent the past impacting future decision-making?
You have to wake up excited to do this job every day, knowing that the next company you see is potentially the next great investment that you're able to make and the next great founder that you're lucky enough to meet. And if you don't wake up every day with that renewed excitement to do this job, it's tiring and it's repetitive. We are fortunate enough to meet and see a lot of great founders every year. And I need to actually find joy in that exercise, knowing that I've been doing that exercise year after year. And so I tend to look at every company with the lens of like, how do we invest in this? Like, we probably should invest in this, right? It's probably interesting. And then sometimes you meet a company, you're like, it's not interesting. I should not invest in this. But I'm not a natural optimist, I don't think, but I have an incredibly optimistic mindset in terms of what we do every day. Our job is to find the long-term unique outliers, and that has to come through dreaming alongside the founders.
Really, last one, I promise, before the quick fire. A decision-making process internally for you. Some have, you know, unanimity required. Others have, yeah, one person pounding the table. What's the decision-making process for you?
I have a great team. My partners, Nimi, Adam, Greg, Adina, and Claire, we love working together. And our job is to make each other better. And I think in decision-making, that applies more so than anything. We work together because we trust each other. We trust that each of us understands what the job is, and sort of our business work is to make great decisions. And so as I look at our decision-making process, we call it advocacy-driven. My partner Nimi came up with the term. It's a nice set of buzzwords put together. But what it means is, in a given deal, somebody has to want to do the deal. And our job is to help that person get to their conviction as best as we can. And so what is it that we can do to help them do better with how they're thinking about it? You know, sometimes the advocates are three or four or five of us where it's like, oh, we should definitely invest in that company. But sometimes it's just one person. And our job is to help that person get to a good decision.
I do want to move into the quick fire, because I could chat to you all day, David. So I say a short statement, you give me your immediate thoughts. Does that sound okay?
I think we can do that.
Let's do it. Okay, so what's the must-watch Netflix right now for you, David?
I have three little kids, and I'm trying to teach my kids through different ways. And what I've gotten them into is Planet Earth and Blue Planet and all the sort of David Attenberg narrated documentaries. And rewatching those under the sort of eyes of a five-year-old is probably the coolest thing I've done in a long time.
I love them too. So that's great to hear. What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you started Box?
What do I know now? Not a lot. And that's actually the answer, is that you are inherently living in uncertainty in this position as a job. You are every day only as good as yesterday, but the only results you know are the results from 10 years ago. So I can't live off of my 10-year-old decisions, but that's the only actual feedback loop I have. And I'm only as good as I was today and yesterday. So you have to be comfortable with uncertainty. uncertainty.
What's your biggest advice to angels starting investing today?
Invest. Investors invest, right? Like, you're not going to outsmart the room. You're not going to outsmart sort of a deal. You're not this magical reason why a company is going to succeed or fail. If you like something, invest in it.
What three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
Empathy, kindness, and determination.
What's the hardest challenge for you today with Box?
I think our challenge is every day the same challenge, which it was 10 years ago, which is find the next great company and be fortunate enough to invest in it.
Who's the best board member that you've seen in action and why?
We don't sit on boards.
What about the companies that you've been invested in though, and they've been like super impactful board members? Have you seen those?
I think it's incredible when a company is able to get a total outsider who is unique in their perspective to join the board and bring a non-investor lens, an operator lens, a sort of external experience lens to a company. I think that can really help.
And then final one, what's the most recent publicly announced investment and why did you say yes and get so excited?
Today, Ramp announced a pretty big round. And Ramp is a company that we've been fortunate enough to invest in since the seed round. This is a second time entrepreneur team. They sold their first company to Capital One. They came out determined. They knew exactly what they were going to build, sort of the quality of what they were going to build, and sort of the way they were going to go build the company. And they are executing in a world-class way. I think the product sort of just jumps out to you. So that's one. And then there's another company that we invested in that hasn't announced yet, but it's called Catch. It's a sort of payment product. It's going to be live pretty soon, and it's one worth keeping an eye on.
David, I always love chatting to you. I can't thank you enough for putting up with my protruding...
I like the aggressive Harry. I think we should do this again. I'm all for it.
It was a bit more aggressive, huh?
Yeah, it's good.
Well, I mean, there you go. At least you know now that I do have opinions and I don't just agree with everyone. Tell me what you think, though, of the more opinionated Harry. I'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback. You can email me, harry@the20minutevc.com, Instagram, hstebbings1996 with two Bs. Always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support and I can't wait to bring you some phenomenal episodes.